From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, Governor Andrew Cuomo marks the 16th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. We'll examine the results of the statewide primary elections this week. And it's the centennial of women's suffrage in New York, where the Capitol was considered a bastion of the anti-suffrage movement. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Andrew Cuomo, in what has become an annual event for the New York governor, led a motorcycle ride along the path of a New York City firefighter rescue team to commemorate the 16th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks this week. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Riders, please remember to ride two by two.
Cuomo was introduced by actor Robert De Niro at a luncheon at the Javits Center in Manhattan just before the final leg of the motorcycle ride.
When they told me I'd be meeting a motorcycle gang, I was expecting something like the Hell's Angels. You know, a group of aging dudes with rotting leather jackets and teeth. Not even close.
De Niro's speech was a light moment in the program, which honored the firefighters who responded when the two hijacked planes struck the World Trade Center's Twin Towers on September 11, 2001. Over 3,000 people lost their lives that day. Governor Cuomo, who rode with around 400 other motorcyclists along the same route that the Rescue 1 firefighters made that day, says the members of the company defied every natural human instinct when they raced toward danger instead of running away. 11 of the brigade died that day out of a total of 344 firefighters overall.
The greatest cowards drove a plane into the top of the building. And the greatest heroes ran in the door in the bottom of the building. The best and the worst of humanity in that very same moment.
The governor says the after effects of 9/11 are not over, and many involved in the rescue efforts have been diagnosed with related illnesses like cancer and respiratory disease. He signed a bill that will ensure unlimited sick leave benefits for public sector workers who became ill as a result of rescue, recovery, and cleanup efforts at the World Trade Center sites.
Any government employee who gets sick from anywhere in the state of New York and the sickness is related to their work on 9/11, they will get health care coverage at no cost to themselves. They will get vacation coverage and sick coverage at no cost to themselves because they paid literally with their health to help New Yorkers, and the state of New York is going to be there for them 100%. And our message is simple. We will always have your back. Sacrifice is a two-way street. Thank you and God bless you.
The workers affected will get 100% of their regular salary at the time of their diagnosis for as long as they are out on sick leave. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Meanwhile, a short but solemn remembrance ceremony was held on the SUNY Plattsburgh campus in New York's North Country this week to remember the events of 9/11. And two alumni there who died when the towers fell. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there.
For the past 16 years, students and faculty have gathered at the edge of Hawkins Pond at noon on 9/11 for a brief memorial service.
And I am far from home.
The Omicron Delta Kappa Leadership Honor Society coordinates the commemoration each year. President William Hodge told the crowd there are timeless lessons that must be remembered in hopes that tragic events like 9/11 never happen again.
At the forefront of these lessons is to teach individuals, groups, communities, states, and countries to resolve conflict in nonviolent and peaceful ways. I'd like to note a memorial was installed next to Hawkins Pond. This memorial is placed here to remind us all of all the individuals that died and were affected by the events that took place on September 11, 2001. There are many people connected to the greater SUNY Plattsburgh family that suffered. In particular, we have dedicated this memorial to two Plattsburgh State alumni who perished in the collapse of the World Trade Centers. There are Robert Sutcliffe, a 1984 graduate who worked as a broker for Harvey, Young & Yerman, and William Irwin, a 1992 graduate who was a broker for Cantor Fitzgerald.
Student Association President Vrinda Kumar was a child in Dubai when the towers fell.
9/11 is an ugly reminder of how some can allow hate to take over their soul. I was 7 years old. I could not understand why this was happening. And 16 years later, I still don't understand why it happened and why such incidents of hate take over and take place in so many parts of the world today. However, to me, 9/11 is also a reminder of how people can come together, because after the attacks, I also saw something else. I saw firefighters, policemen, different members of the society, regardless of their role, coming together and helping one another. And that's how I wish that you remember this incident also.
Despite being very young, 9/11 is an indelible memory for these campus leaders. Hodge remembers walking his school hallways with his parents.
I was 4 years old, and I actually was registering for my first day of kindergarten. And you could just see in the classrooms, in the older classrooms, you saw the students crying, you saw the teachers crying. As you got down further and further, you would only see teachers crying and the students confused. It's painted vividly in my head.
Kumar says remembering 9/11 is particularly relevant given the increase in violent incidents around the world.
Look around Paris, London, some parts of Middle East, some parts of South Asia. It's happening. You know, 9/11s are happening for those specific countries all around. It's definitely should be done more to remind people how it is important to have that conversation about hate and how it is important to have that conversation about inclusion.
The Plattsburgh State Art Museum is displaying Tempered by Memory by sculptor Noah Savitt, which uses steel from the World Trade Center. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gastina. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, is off this week and will return next week instead. I spoke with Ken Lovett, Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Daily News, about the primary elections across the state this week, the results, and their significance.
We'll start with the sort of lead primary of the week, which would be New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio breezes through the primary, 74% of the vote. The sort of backtalk was, would Cuomo endorse de Blasio? Would de Blasio endorse Cuomo? Cuomo had said, well, I don't live in the city.
You know, for a while, we were calling the two frenemies, you know, friends who are sometimes enemies. I don't think that's really the phrase anymore. They are now full-blown enemies, and they have been for quite a while. And the governor refused notably to endorse the mayor's primary in the Democratic primary. And just for way of background, they had been friends. They had worked together at HUD. And when the governor was the HUD secretary under Bill Clinton, you know, he hired de Blasio. And if you remember in 2014, when the governor was going for the Working Families Party nomination, you know, it's a minor party, but it's union backed. It's very liberal and progressive. And the governor, they didn't want to back the governor. And it was Mayor de Blasio who stepped in and helped the governor get that endorsement. And get
came up to Albany here, right?
Came up to Albany and pulled his acorns out of the fire, as they say. This time around, the governor gave him no such kind of help. Not that he needed it, but at first, and it was laughable, not almost laughable. His reason was, I don't live in the city, so I can't vote in the mayoral primary, so I'm not going to take a stand. Which is hilarious because he had already endorsed 4 New York City council members.
Right.
He went on to endorse 6 of them. He endorsed the Nassau County in the Nassau County executive race and others. And the reality is, the governor is the governor. He's the titular head of the Democratic Party. He endorses people outside of his Westchester County voting area all the time. But he refused to do so. And as I said, his reasoning drew a lot of scoffing and laughing because, you know, to say, oh, I don't vote in the city was really not even an attempt to hide how much you dislike de Blasio if you're the governor.
Well, it looks like the governor got some help with this race in Suffolk County.
Well, the governor certainly did because I had a column on Monday that said there was a race for Suffolk County sheriff that involved a state senator, Phil Boyle, a Republican, a longtime incumbent. He's also conservative. He was expected to win, and the feeling was that there was a deal cut that if he won, which would open up his Senate seat in January, instead of waiting till January, he would resign almost immediately, which would allow for a special election in November. The Republicans had asked him basically to do that because they feel they have a better chance when it's not a general election to win the race there. And there would have been a lot of pressure on the governor. I wrote on Monday that the Democrats want him to financially help that race. It would have been a difficult race for them, but they feel that if the governor would have helped raise money and given money from the state party and done other things, they would have a chance of winning it. And obviously that all ties into fight for control of the state Senate, which the Democrats have a numerical majority right now, but they don't control the chamber because there's 8 breakaway Democrats who are aligned with the Republicans and then a 9th who actually sits with the Republicans. So the governor was going to face a lot of pressure. Well, that pressure is no more right now because Phil Boyle surprisingly lost the election. And so his Senate seat is still filled. And then there's other primaries that could impact the race for the Senate next year. You know, Ruben Diaz from the Bronx, he won a city council primary. He has said he's going to stay on till the end of the year, which means the Democrats will go into the new year with a vacancy there. And George Latimer, a senator from Westchester County, won his Democratic primary for a county executive. If he beats Rob Astorino in November, that's a second seat that the Democrats are going to have to make up, you know, going into the new year.
All right, let's move on to some of the other races. I guess the major races were the mayoral races. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan breezes to another term.
Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, yeah, there were no real surprises. I mean, you know, Sheehan won. Byron Brown in Buffalo,
right,
who's an ally of the governor, who's the co-chair of the state party, he won. You had Syracuse. There was a little bit of a surprise.
Explain that one.
Well, you know, the party candidate didn't win.
That's right.
And he's lost, I think, 3 out of 4 now in the primaries. But the woman who did win is a former Cuomo aide and someone who's close to Cuomo. And why that's important,
right,
is that Stephanie Miner, who's the current mayor who is term limited out and was once Cuomo's handpicked co-chairwoman of the state party and has since been feuding with him because she dared to criticize him publicly over policy. She and the governor do not like each other. The governor doesn't really go to Syracuse much. When he's in the area, he doesn't invite her to events.
Recently at the state fair?
Recently at the state fair, she was not there with him. So it would be different for the governor to have an ally in Syracuse at City Hall. So that was an interesting race. You know, again, Byron Brown is. You know, de Blasio won.
Lovely Warren in Rochester.
Rochester, she won hers.
Which is an embattled city.
Which is an embattled city, but it wasn't unexpected that she would win and win big. So, you know, no real surprise. I think the biggest surprise was the Phil Boyle race.
Sure, on Suffolk County.
Hiram Montserrat, we don't usually focus on city council races up here, but an assemblyman, Francisco Moya, was challenging Hiram Montserrat. If you remember that name, he was a state senator who became the first state lawmaker who was voted out of the legislature by the legislature after he was convicted of misdemeanor assault in which he slashed his girlfriend with a glass. So he had been bounced from the legislature, and then he went to the city council, and he was serving there until he was convicted, or actually he was at the city council first, excuse me. But after he got bounced from the legislature, he was convicted of having misappropriated funds for personal use from the city council.
I'm shocked.
And then he tried to run again for council this year, but Moya beat him easily.
Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Daily News with us this week. Alan will be back. Don't worry.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York City Department of Environmental Protection has started a major phase of its largest repair project ever. Officials visited a shaft construction site in Orange County, New York, recently to mark the start of tunneling for a bypass tunnel across the Hudson River. Construction workers in Newburgh are lowering the tunnel boring machine that will make its way from Orange to Dutchess County. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
The billion-dollar Delaware Aqueduct repair project is underway to address two leaks in the 85-mile Delaware Aqueduct, the longest tunnel in the world. The larger of the two leaks is on the western bank of the Hudson River in Newburgh. DEP Acting Commissioner Vincent Sapienza says the effort to fix the aqueduct is the most complex his agency has undertaken.
The Delaware Aqueduct, which was built in the 1940s, has a leak which we need to repair. And the solution that was come up with was to build a parallel tunnel right alongside the Delaware Aqueduct. And so this project here that we're doing is to put a tunnel boring machine down a deep shaft to run parallel to the Delaware Aqueduct, the existing tunnel. It's going to take about 2 years for this boring machine to make its way from Newburgh to Wappingers, about 2.5 miles. And once the parallel tunnel is built, we can then connect that to the existing Delaware Aqueduct to basically bypass the leaking section.
He says patching the leak would take too long, and New York City would not be able to survive on the limited amount of water that would be deliverable. And the tunnel boring machine, which, when assembled, will be more than 470 feet long and weigh upwards of 2.7 million pounds, is named Nora, for the first woman in the U.S. to earn a civil engineering degree. Nora Stanton Blatch DeForest Barney earned her degree in 1905 from Cornell University and worked for the predecessor to the DEP. Colleen Jenkins is her granddaughter.
This is a real woman who's a groundbreaker, and this is a groundbreaking machine. And so it was a very easy choice to make. I think somebody proposed Superwoman. But, you know, I think that I'm a little tired of generic, fictitious women. Real women exist.
Jenkins says Nora the Human was also a suffragist and granddaughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
And I'm going to end with a suffrage saying, and it is forward into the light. And what I want to do is adapt it to today for tunneling, forward into the light at the end of the tunnel.
Orange County Executive Steve Newhouse was on hand for the ceremony for the start of tunneling.
I think it's a great thing, a $1 billion investment, lots of men and women working on this job, and it's an engineering marvel. This is what you watch on History Channel that they did back in the day that you don't think they can do anymore today. This is a modern marvel.
The DEP's Sapienza says while work goes on below ground, the public will notice the following above ground.
So right now we're standing on top of basically a 800-foot deep shaft. And so piece by piece, this tunnel boring machine is going to be lowered into the hole, pieced together and moving. You won't see any of this machine anymore, but what you will see is pulverized rock being brought to the surface every day, going onto trucks, and then being brought off site.
Sapienza notes this is one of the largest public works projects taking place in the Hudson Valley, on the heels of the construction of the new Tappan Zee Bridge.
The Tappan Zee Bridge is moving cars and we're moving water.
The finished bypass tunnel will be reinforced by 9,200 linear feet of steel and a second layer of concrete. DEP will then shut down the Delaware Aqueduct to connect the bypass tunnel to the aqueduct. The about 6-month shutdown is planned for October 2022. The project is expected to be finished in 2023. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
It's the centennial of women's suffrage in New York, but there's no suffrage story without the anti-suffrage story. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas attended the opening of an exhibit at the Albany Institute of History and Art that shows the Capitol was considered a bastion of the anti-suffrage movement.
The years leading up to 1917 were fraught with difficulty, both politically and personally, for women on both sides of the argument. Not every woman wanted the right to vote. Tammas Groft is executive director of the Albany Institute of History and Art.
The exhibition that we have here really tells the story of women, the women who first met in 1894 before the New York Constitutional Convention convened and organized the Albany branch of the New York State Association opposed to women's suffrage. They lobbied to make their views heard in 1915, ultimately, of course, lost in 1917.
It's hard to imagine American women not having the right to vote today. The exhibition serves to tell a compelling story about a group of women, 8,000 in all, who were simply not interested.
And it's also connected directly to the Albany Institute of History and Art, because quite a number of the meetings were held at the Albany Institute. And if you look at the list of people who were involved in the anti-suffrage movement, you'll see that many of them are very familiar to us because they're the wives of the board members at the Albany Institute.
As we toured the exhibit, I asked the Institute's Patrick Stenshorn to describe the mindset of the anti-suffragists.
They believed that the role for women in society was in the home, and their way to advance society was through charitable work, through educating their kids by raising good citizens, but not necessarily being active in the political process.
College of St. Rose president Carolyn Stefanko is a guest curator for the exhibit's section on suffrage. She notes that New York was also central to the pro-suffrage crusade.
At Seneca Falls, the women's rights movement really emerged in an official way as a movement. And so many of the significant proponents for women's suffrage came to New York, worked in New York, were headquartered in New York. And so New York really, the state as well as Albany, really plays such a significant role in both of these stories. And of course, they're intertwined.
Albany Democratic State Assemblywoman Pat Fahey believes activists today should take note of what their 20th century counterparts did and did not accomplish.
And I think this is what we've lost a little bit in society, especially these days at the national level. We've forgotten how to listen and learn from both sides.
The exhibit runs through spring. There's more at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1737. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.